Okay, joining me today is Alan Butler of Butler on the Business. You can hear his own show on the link below with Liberty Express, and he has a firm grip on the economy. Mr. Butler, welcome to the program.
Well, nice to have me.
You know, when I was in college, I had a professor of statistics who told me that we've done a pretty good job combating illiteracy, but there's a vast swath of the population who are innumerate. That is, they don't know how to read statistics, and there's that problem, but there's also a problem with schematics in the way that the press and politicians pretty much lie and manipulate statistics even when the numbers are good. And what I'd like to talk about today is a few different numbers, the jobs report number to start out with, and then also the so-called unemployment rate as well as inflation. But starting with the jobs report number, that's not actually the number of jobs that have been added or lost per month, is it?
No, it's not. The headline number that gets reported by the media is the variance between what the BLS was expecting and what actually occurred. And let's take the report we got for the month of January. I don't have the data in front of me, so I'm working off the top of my head, but I believe what we were told, we added 133,000 jobs into the U.S. economy in the month of January 2014. In reality, we lost 2,820,000 jobs, which was 133,000 fewer than was forecasted by the BLS. Now, in the interest of fairness, in the month of February, the media reported that we added 175,000 jobs, but we actually added 750. Again, the difference being the variance between what was expected and what actually occurred. Where that leaves us, though, through the 2 months ended February 28th, is we're down about 1,800,000 jobs. Excuse me, it's 2,080,000 jobs for the first 2 months of the year, which is a 14% year-over-year decline. If you dig into the weeds of that 750,000 jobs, only 300,000 of those were private sector jobs, and that represented a 46% plunge from February a year ago. Now, I do think the BLS could do a little bit better job educating the media on how to read the reports, but I've been schooled by the former commissioner of the BLS, who has taken a good deal of time teaching me the reports, and we have had many hours of discussion on why the media have the inability to pick up this report and interpret what was actually in the report. And part of it is...
Well, is it incompetence or is that intentional? That's one question.
We've wrestled with that. I think probably the lion's share of it is ignorance on a massive scale. That's the number one thing I would point to. Back in the day, we used to have a large press corps, and we used to have a lot of business reporters who would actually look at the underlying data in each of these reports. Now what we've got is reporting by government press release. So if the Obama administration chooses to give us the variance number, what they call the seasonal adjustment, the media will just take that number and run with it, and they'll beat us over the head with it every month and lead us to believe that, you know, we've added almost 300,000 jobs so far this year when we're down 2 million.
Yeah, I mean, it's really we lost less than we expected, and they're reporting that as gains in jobs.
Exactly, just like Representative Paul Ryan came out with his budget proposal. After voting to waive the debt ceiling, and now he's gotten austerity and he's quote unquote cutting $5 trillion from the federal spending over the next 10 years. And as I look at it, spending increases every single year in all 10 years. So where are the cuts?
Well, that whole fiasco was basically, we're going to increase it less than we were planning to increase it. And we're calling that a decrease.
Well, and in many months, the jobs report will look exactly the same way.
How do they get away with that?
We just have an incompetent media, is my only explanation. Now, the politicians are motivated to look to the lowest number. They said that Richard Nixon, during the Nixon years, Nixon would have the BLS report, whichever of the two numbers look better, either the numbers coming from the household survey or the numbers coming from the payroll survey. And he would pick, depending on which one gave the better numbers, that particular report, and they would report that. Speaking of those two surveys, we've got almost 1 million job discrepancy for 2013 between the household survey and the payroll survey, and that's got people scratching their head that actually know how to read the report.
You also have to take into account how many of the jobs that were created are government jobs, and then how many of the jobs that were created versus what were lost, say manufacturing versus more lower end jobs that are not paying the same as the jobs that were lost.
Well, in the month of February, it was 60% government, 40% private sector. And again, that private sector number was a 46% decline versus February a year ago. Now we're going to get a new report on Friday for the month of March. I know historically, we should be adding about 850,000 jobs. Now, if they were going to manipulate the number for the headline's sake, they could simply just lower the anticipated number and get a better headline number. But that will still leave us down around 1,200,000 jobs year-to-date through 3 months, which is a bad trend. We've had four consecutive bad jobs reports, despite how they've been represented by the media.
Well, surprising, given all the quantitative easing and easy money, you think there'd be more employment, right?
Well, that's an entirely different subject. I think the quantitative easing may be hurting the hiring instead of helping it.
Well, I was being facetious. I was being sarcastic. But that's true. And so that's the jobs report number and some of the manipulation there. It just surprises me that Forbes or somebody wouldn't call them out on it and say, you're just quoting the anticipated number, not even the actual number of jobs that have been added or lost. It seems pretty simple to call them out on it, because the numbers are there if you go directly to the tables and look at them. It's just the sort of, it's the politicians in the press that are filtering it out, and I don't know if that's incompetence or intentional or whatever, but that seems to be the case.
On the part of the politicians who are aware, and I think most of them, I had a guy that was a staffer referred to these politicians as being only one slide deep in the presentation. In other words, they don't really know what they're doing. But the politicians clearly are responsible for the lion's share of how things get reported. For example, claiming that the U3 is the quote-unquote unemployment rate, the now G8, which used to be the G7, which may be the G7 again, depending on what they do with Russia, they all got together a few years ago and agreed that they would make the U3 the quote-unquote unofficial jobless, or the official unemployment rate in all these countries. So that's how we're being, that's what we're told.
But can you explain what the conditions are that have to be met to get counted as unemployed under U3? Because it's pretty ridiculous.
Yes, it is. Well, first, you had to have had a job that you lost. So if you never had a job to begin with, for example, if you just aged your way into the workforce, but have yet to get a job, then you're not counted. For example, if you graduated from college and have yet to get a job and you don't have a job, you're not counted. So in order to be counted in the U3, first, you had to have lost a job in the first place. Secondly, it had to have occurred within the last 26 weeks. And third, you had to go on a job interview in the last 4 weeks. Now, one problem that we've got is most of the job searching these days takes place on the internet. Well, in the United States, they do not count people who are looking for a job on the internet as actually looking for a job. Now, the irony of the U3, and particularly with it being counted as the unemployment rate, at 27 weeks, you're no longer in the U3. But I'm sure you're...
First of all, what is the U3? About 6.5% or something, they're saying?
Well, last month, through February, it was 6.7%.
Okay. That's not even close.
No. Well, if we go back to the classical definition when the BLS first got started, which is not working but would work if work were available, and I think you and I both would agree that that's a very good definition. Not working but would work if work were available, that number is around 24%. But back to the U3, I'm sure all of the listeners will recall that we had 99 weeks of extended unemployment benefits. And there's a proposal to re-up that and to continue with the 99 weeks. That means that the U.S.
Go ahead.
The U.S. government sent unemployment checks for an additional 73 weeks to people they were not considering unemployed. We were sending them unemployment checks, but not counting them as being unemployed in the U3. And the average unemployed person is 37 weeks, so even the average unemployed person isn't counted in the U3. The U3 has been rendered basically a meaningless number. And I know that the BLS would like to get away from all of the U's. The two that are really used are the U3 and the U6. The U6 counts you up to 365 days. Once you've gone 366 days or 52 weeks, then you're no longer counted in that number either.
Mm-hmm. But it's usually the U3 that's on the forefront. That's the unemployment rate as they report it anyway.
Yes, the U3, when they refer to the unemployment rate and tell us it's 6.7%, what they're talking about is the U3.
Now, I remember President Clinton got rid of unemployment with the stroke of a pen.
He defined away 5 million people out of the U6.
How did he do that?
Well, that's when we got the notion of a discouraged worker. So if those people had not actively been on an interview in the last 4 weeks, they were defined away. They took them out of the workforce.
Oh, it's like Bush and Obama saying, we're not allowed to torture prisoners of war or POWs, so they're not POWs, they're enemy combatants, and now we can torture them. Schematics.
That's a good example.
Well, there are many of those, unfortunately, but the number that that creeps me out the most is how we are being told that there's only 1% inflation. How are they getting that number? Because anybody that goes to the grocery store can tell you there's more than 1% inflation.
I think the last number we got was 1.5%. Well, what they do is anytime they have a problem, they just redefine the problem and the problem goes away. The BLS will go out and price check 80,000 goods every month. And that's empirical data. That data also is in a table. And you can have your own CPI if you want to. Just pick the items out of that table that you buy and track inflation yourself. What happens is that from these 80,000 items, the government will generate multiple indices, and then you can pick and choose various indices. So the CPIU, that one's had a history of constantly going through methodology revisions to the point that inflation, if we took the raw items that are in those 80,000 items that are price checked every month, and we tallied the inflation rate the way they did under, say, Ronald Reagan and Paul Volcker, then that benign 1.5% inflation rate morphs into 8.8%. A more recent example is what they did with the PPI, the Producer Price Index. They changed the method for tallying the Producer Price Index effective January 1st of this year. And the first report we got off of the new method was 0.7% annualized. But had they gone back to using the method they used on December 31st, 2013, their 0.7% annualized would have been 5.5%. So they just defined away almost all of the inflation out of the PPI. The unfortunate thing is the media pick up on the 0.7%, and that's what gets reported, and that's what we're told. So we've got this narrative going on that we have no inflation. Ironically, if you look at the inflation table they use for tallying food stamp benefits, then over the last 5 years, where we have had a little less than 9% accumulative inflation in the CPIU, using the food stamp table, that index, we've had 35% inflation. In other words, about 7% annualized in food. Now, I do know that so far this year, it's significantly higher than the 7%. But for the 5 years ended December 31st, 2013, that five-year period, food prices have gone up 35%, and they have calculated food stamp benefits on that index. So food stamp recipients have seen over a five-year period a 35% bump, where Social Security recipients have seen but a fraction of that. The CPIU is no longer a gauge of inflation. It is a metric by which they calculate cost of living adjustments for Social Security recipients. And to lower that number, they've lowered the inflation rate as reported by the CPIU.
And that's only the agricultural or the food stock part of the consumer price index. It's not even including electricity and some of the other daily things that people need that should be in that basket.
In that core CPI, they have removed food and fuel. In the core inflation rate, they no longer count food and fuel. The argument is those are volatile. Yeah, they're volatile in one direction, always up. You might have a dip from 1 month to the next, let's say in gasoline, but if you look at the trend, it's always up year over year.
Yeah, obviously. And that's part and parcel with the inflation of the dollar as well. Well, there are many factors, but you can see that trade agreements and things, of course, but mainly printing too much money. It seems to be one of the culprits.
Well, I would argue that the printing is the culprit.
Well, yeah. But no one is held accountable for this. I mean, it's pretty simple to look at the manipulations and see that they're being completely dishonest. And yet, and people like yourself can point it out, like, look, they are not only manipulating the CPI, they're also manipulating the producer side of it as well, and we can say what we've just been over, and yet no one gets held accountable for these things. Why aren't, it seems like it would be a hot story. How is it possible that nobody in the press can just sit down and explain this?
I think for the most part, the press is ignorant, and those who are ignorant are complicit. It really has devolved into reporting by government press release. But what will always aggravates me is this Friday on the Tout networks, the Tout TV networks, the financial networks here in the United States, they'll have a panel of people, and they will all be sitting around guessing what the unemployment number is about to be. And none of them have a clue. Now, I don't really fault the anchors. They're just reading off of a teleprompter. I don't fault the copywriters because they're just reading a press release. The people that I take exception to are the ones who are supposedly the experts. Now, CNBC will have a former economist with the White House, that Austin Goolsbee. And he'll sit there and throw out numbers too. And with him, I'm scratching my head. Is this guy that ignorant, where he was the chief economist for the White House Council of Economic Advisors, and he doesn't know how to read this report, or is he just pushing the official narrative? That is one fella in particular that I have trouble with. But I mean, he's just one of many that are so-called experts. And then the Saturday business shows, you see them on Fox. Mm-hmm. Those people will all be sitting around the table banning about the unemployment number, the number of jobs added, and none of those people have a clue. They're all reading the official release. It's like one guy gets it wrong, and then the rest of them have it wrong.
Well, I've seen the mass media mess up on basic geography, so it shows you how top-down that is and how much cut and pasting and teleprompter reading and lack of thinking there is. But my favorite example of incompetence or absolute ignorance, scary level, was Congressman Bob Goodlatte of Virginia, who said in front of a full crowd, he was over at UVA, and he was giving a speech and telling them that inflation is good for savings. And, you know, he's got his tie and everything up there. And, of course, the people in the crowd were miffed and said, wait, how can inflation be good for your savings? And he didn't try to backpedal and say, well, I misspoke or anything like that. He just continued to try and rationalize his position that inflation is good for your savings. And he got reelected.
Yep. Well, that one's a new one on me. What? How did he say inflation is good for your savings? That one's a mystery. I've heard that it's supposedly good for spending, but how is it good for your savings?
He went into some, you know, hokum about, well, you could have bought oil futures or something, but that's not savings. That's an investment. But, I mean, he didn't really have a good defense for that. He just declared it. And the people in the audience thought, well, no, that's the very antithesis of it. I mean, inflation is not good for savings. That's kind of what it is, you know. But
inflation is really good for government.
Oh,
because they can inflate away a portion of their debt.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the thing with government too, is they're spending other people's money. So when it's their debt, yes, it's their debt because they created it, but they don't pay the debt. We pay the debt. They personally profit just fine. So the burden's left on the taxpayer, either through austerity or inflation or higher taxes. That's who has to pay the debt ultimately. But the politician personally doesn't really care. And I think that's why they don't really know a lot about economics over in Capitol Hill.
Yeah, there are very few that understand the economy in Washington, D.C.
Well, are there any other big numbers that they have been manipulating besides inflation and the jobs report and the unemployment rate? Is there anything else we ought to tackle?
Well, the one is the GDP, which spurious as that measure is, if you understate the inflation rate, you automatically overstate the GDP. And it's a one-to-one correlation. So if you understate inflation by 1%, you're overstating in GDP by 1%. And if we look at the GDP numbers, you know, supposedly, according to the official narrative, and they talk out of both sides of their mouth on this one, but the U.S. economy has never been better. It's never been as large. It's as robust as it has ever been, according to the GDP. And yet, in the next breath, they'll talk about all this help and why we need to keep printing the money and extend these unemployment benefits and entertain more stimulus. Well, if the economy is more robust than it's ever been, why do we need to do that? Because even the politicians who embrace the GDP numbers also recognize that we're still in a recession. If you accurately count the inflation rate, we've had no recovery. This economy has yet to recover, not only from the 2008 recession, we haven't fully recovered from the one that we saw in 2000 when you properly account for the inflation rate.
It's amazing because when you combine the Federal Reserve's bailouts plus the government's bailouts, you're looking at a surplus of $20 trillion. And where did that money go? And even if you are looking at GDP, and even if you had the correct numbers, you still have to slice it up and see how centralized the wealth is, because we've got all these financials getting this enormous amount of credit for their mortgage-backed security scandal and basically fraud with the rating agencies giving AAA ratings to CDOs that are absolute junk. And again, nobody's held accountable and nothing is explained, and just $20 trillion disappears. And obviously, it's got to hurt the economy, but they wouldn't liquidate the bad assets or the gambling. And most of the people who are primarily responsible for causing that just got bonuses. And yet, Obama got reelected, and most of the congressmen got reelected who participated in the bailouts and that whole process. But once again, you also had the talking heads, the guys wearing makeup on TV, saying that we had to do it. They're too big to fail, and there was no other option. And of course, we have austerity from that. And yet, no one went to jail, and well, a few people, but very few people went to jail, and nobody seemed to really be held accountable for their actions there. Especially
let me ask. Let me ask you a question. Since you live in Japan, and we can see the failure of Abenomics, and we know that
we call them Ahonomics.
What does your inflation rate look like? What does the average person on the street see over there? Certainly much higher than the official numbers.
Of course, but what everyone's mad about it today is that yesterday the consumption tax went up to 8% from 5%, and it's set to reach 10% in October. So I watch all my train ticket prices and gas prices and everything jolt up a dime per stop, basically. And a lot of businesses, some of them are refusing to do it. But Shinzo Abe, I don't know, he calls it Abenomics, but his entire plan has just been a disaster. You know, Japan's been through what they call the lost decade or lost generation or whatever. You know, there's a bunch of nicknames for it, but we watched the yen versus the dollar, for example. And the dollar, we know, has been inflating about 7% or so. And the yen, it took about 75 cents to equal $1. In the process of about 6 months, it was even at 100. So the dollar was falling, and the yen was falling even faster, and that was from intentional inflation from the Prime Minister Abe. And yet, what did he spend the money on? Because it certainly didn't go to the people or infrastructure or the schools or anything like that. He spent it mostly on the U.S.'s own military equipment. And for the own MIC, buying useless F-22s and F-35s and things that don't even really work for the bases in Okinawa and stuff, which in turn has caused a buildup from China and North Korea and South Korea. Just a big mess all around. And great, start a new arms race and inflated the yen. And it's really hurt the people here because post-Fukushima, you know, Japan imports about 90% of its oil and gas. And after the tsunami, they turned off their nuclear reactors. So that was another 16% of their electricity gone, permanently, pretty much. So they have to make up for that by importing more coal from Canada and oil from the Middle East, etc. And, of course, with the yen being inflated so highly, another, like, a 25% in 1 year, they have to pay more for that. And so regular families are suffering. But it was over 25% it dropped in the course of a year, which is unheard of. Somebody could have made a lot of money, you know, currency hopping, if they had money. You have to have a lot of money to make a lot of money. But for the basic families in Japan, and for myself, there's no way around it. They just depreciated the money on purpose, supposedly to help exports and things, but that's not what actually happened. I don't know who Abe's really working for or what he's thinking, but there are people here who just love him because he's got really good propaganda and he's a really good salesman. He is good at that, but he doesn't know what he's doing on economics.
Well, I can only say that our own Federal Reserve and the Bank of Japan are following basically the same monetary policy, and we're getting the same results.
Yeah, everything costs a lot more, and both the U.S. and the Japanese just gave $1 billion to Ukraine, not to open up another whole issue here at the end of the show, but you can see them definitely working together. And you can see the suffering across the board as well. I mean, in the U.S., like you were saying, 24% is the real unemployment rate. That's about 1 in 4 people. It's basically a quarter who would like to work, and they're not lazy. They want to work, and they can't find a job. in their area. There's just not enough capital to pay people, and so they're not getting paid. And that's just horrible, where you have laborers and they have the skill and they have the knowledge and everything, and there just isn't enough business around to pay these people. They don't have any work they could go to. And we're not really talking about labor so much when the government's talking. The government shouldn't run the economy anyway. They should have nothing to do with it. But when they try to do that, they just create more government jobs, which is, tax parasites. And they're not really investing in capital. And they continue to tax people to death. And I think that would be better served back in the pockets of the businesses that employ people. But again, they group the rich together collectively, but there's a huge difference between rich business people who provide jobs for everyone else underneath them and rich speculators who produce nothing and provide no jobs for anybody. There's a big difference between just the wealthy who are making money gambling in stocks and things and wealthy producers who actually provide jobs and employment for everybody, but they're always lumped together and taxed at the same kind of rates, which is ridiculous in my opinion too.
Well, and because of tax policy, somebody, let's say an actor or an athlete who makes $1 million, that's quite a bit different than an entrepreneur who makes $1 million, because in many cases the entrepreneur is paying income taxes on phantom income. It's due to vagaries in the tax code, mm-hmm. that will ignore certain expenses through time shifting mechanisms like depreciation and things like that, where the entrepreneur is paying income taxes on income that was never earned in the first place.
Yeah, that's a good point as well. But the code is indiscriminate there. They just treat them all the same way, and they don't really pay attention to who is a job provider or whether they ever got their income to begin with. They're not talking about how much went to payroll and so on, whereas the athlete or the actor, they don't have a payroll other than maybe an agent or something, and so they're not burdened by that. But those are some of the same people, these millionaires or multimillionaires, that the kind of limousine liberals that want other people to pay, but they don't understand how that's hurting the middle class and the lower class as well. When you overtax the wealthy, plus with our government, it's not like that money gets redistributed to help the poor. Most of that money gets spent on pointless imperial escapades, starting wars and proxy wars all over the globe, which are costly in life and treasury and only benefit a very select group of corporate interests, and really don't serve American interests whatsoever. I'd rather not tax them at all if they're going to waste it on things like that.
Do you still maintain your U.S. citizenship?
I do. I want to vote in my local and state elections, and I vote in the federal elections as well, even though it's kind of a drop in the bucket. But I'd rather say, it's better than nothing, because otherwise I would just be forfeiting. And I can't get too excited about the Japanese politicians anyway, so I just maintain my citizenship. It's also easier headache-wise on being able to return and seeing family and everything. But, people should participate in the political process, but we really need a philosophical change, I think, economically and just in the way we conduct business and foreign policy and many other things before we can have a real political change. I think we need a social change first. Because I just see them going back and forth, left and right, and it's always basically the same policies. And Obama didn't change anything with Bush. In fact, all the negative things Bush did, Obama exacerbated and made larger. But he could get away with it, I guess. He's a bit more articulate and he had the clout to do it, but very little has changed. And we've still seen trillions of dollars wasted on basically fraud, and then of course all these wars, and the way the taxes are structured, you actually give businesses incentives to leave the country, and so Yeah, it's the same old problems that people have been talking about for my whole life. But the solutions are there, and we never seem to implement them. So that's why I'm doing what I'm doing now, trying to get guests like yourself on with independent media who can say these things. And I'm hoping that with the generation of the internet, who is not dependent on mass media and all the incompetent people we see on TV, as we were just talking about, hopefully things will change that way through an alternative press. Maybe that's the place to start. That's my hope.
And let's hope we can keep it free and out of the influence of the government. How does the average person on the street in Japan view the United States right now?
Well, most people in Japan are apolitical. Oh, I guess most people everywhere are non-political, really. But if you look at the people who pay attention to that kind of thing, the typical answer I get is, we love Americans, we don't like the American government. And I can see that. But some of them did fall for the, well, things are so much better now that Obama's president, right? And I say, well, not really. But they don't really care. They don't really pay attention to the U.S. Government any more than people in America pay attention to what's going on in Japan. I mean, they only know the very major things, and really it's, they don't live there, and there's nothing they can do about it, so they don't really pay it much mind. The things they do think about are TPP and the things that are, you know, involving Japan. But as far as the, you know, domestic policies or U.S.'s you know, proxy war in Syria or what's going on in Ukraine, they really don't know what's going on and, you know, don't really have an opinion on it. That's what I've seen. I'm really political, so I talk to everybody about that, but they just seem to be very Japan-centric, which is typical of any country, really.
Well, I would say probably less than half of the people in the United States pay any attention to politics. You know, there's a frightening number of people here who cannot name a single U.S. senator or the vice president.
It is frightening. But I can understand they kind of feel disenfranchised. Like, why should I know any of that information? We're just watching the show of other people who rule the world. We don't have a say in it. Not really. But, geez, I think you ought to at least know about it. At least know who the vice president is. He's an alcoholic named Joe Biden. yeah, I don't, that's just, it's hard for me to fathom, but it's very believable. I've seen a lot of videos where there are people in the United States who can't really tell you where all 50 states are, even, or know where some of the places that we've recently invaded are even located. And so it's an abysmal level of political discourse. And I think part of that is because the press lies so much that they just decide, why pay attention to any of it? It's never true anyway. And so they get divorced from that and, I don't know, sucked into entertainment or something else that's more enjoyable and just quit paying attention. I don't know. I'm not one of those people, but I definitely have seen that when I used to live there.
How many Americans live in Japan?
I don't know. There are a lot of foreigners. About 1% or so are not from Japan, but I would say the majority of the foreigners are from Korea, China, Brazil, the United Kingdom, Australia, and then probably the United States in that order. But it depends. There tend to be a lot of Americans in Tokyo and Kyoto, but not so much in the outside of that, really. And when they come, they're either specific. There are a lot of Americans in the bases, obviously. They're all Americans. And there are some language instructors and other businesses, but 99% of Japan is Japanese.
Do you guys all, do you guys all hang out together?
I don't know what they do. Most of my friends are Japanese, but I live in a very inaka or like country area in Nara, and so there are not a lot of foreign people around myself. But in the big cities, there are cliques, and they hang out together because they have English as a native language, and it certainly is easier than speaking Japanese. So There's a community of expats here. There is some James Corbett and Michael Kyle and some others with myself who are doing similar things, sticking on politics. Well, actually, James is Canadian, but still, there is a community of expats, and we do hang out with like-minded individuals, but it doesn't really matter to me where somebody's from. It's just a lot easier to meet Japanese people because there are more of them. But I would think it's pretty integrated. I wouldn't say there are too many foreigners who are in a little bubble of only hanging out with other foreigners or something. That might go on, but I don't know why they would live here if that were the case, because they'd be a super, super minority.
It's interesting. Do you have a fairly large English-speaking population for your media endeavors?
Most of my media are Americans, and then Canadians, Brits, Australians, and there are a lot of Japanese listeners, I think, because of the time zones. And there are, I mean, Japanese people who speak English, but the bulk of the audience are from English-speaking countries. They're larger, and there are more English speakers, and I do my media in English. I rarely do reports in Japanese unless it's, you know, some kind of topic that's specifically about Japan, because it's hard. That's my reason.
Is the job market there as weak as it is here in the U.S.?
Oh, it's horrible. It's absolutely abysmal. If you get a good job, hold on to it, wherever you live. It's really bad, and it's really bad for foreigners as well. I think it's a little harder. You get kind of stereotyped into certain occupations, but it's a lovely place to visit, though. Don't be scared of radiation. I've had shows about that people can listen to in the archives. There are two extreme camps there. There are people who, there's sort of the doomsday cultists making a buck off of fearmonger media, and then there are the TEPCO folks who would like to deny anything's going on at all, which is also preposterous. But the Olympics are going to come soon, and Japan's still a very wonderful place to live and to visit. And if you are worried about environmental factors, then come to the western part of Japan. Hit up Osaka, Nara, Hiroshima, or Okinawa down south. Very far removed from Fukushima, it's perfectly safe. I just gave a little infomercial. But Mr. Butler, I thank you for coming on the show and talking about economics with me. And maybe next time we'll flip it around and we can talk about Japanese economics.
I'd love to. And I'd like to have you on my own show as well, which starts in 11 minutes. So this is a good time to wrap up.
All right. Well, maybe not today, because it's 11 p.m. and I have another guest coming. But I definitely would love to be on your show and talk economics or whatever you need. So I love it. And your show is linked right below, and people can see Butler on Business, and I highly recommend it. Thanks for coming.
Hey, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir.
Bye-bye.